Yeah, that's what I was wondering. So Council, I'll just make a few remarks as you're getting yourself situated, and I just want to check initially. So let's see, is this Mr. Ellig, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
This is your client sitting next to you? So our normal custom in our court is to have the clients remain behind the bar unless they are counsel.
I don't intend to change the court's policy.
Yeah, yeah.
A longtime reader, first-time order.
And I hope you understand, Mr. Markison. Okay, thank you so much. We're happy to have you here in court today and looking forward to hearing the arguments in your case. So as I mentioned, if you were in the courtroom earlier, we ask you to do a couple of things. First of all, please take your time as you get up to the podium and situate yourself and adjust the microphone, have your materials ready. We are looking forward to the conversation with you this morning. Before you start your remarks, if you would help us out with our oral record, we ask you to identify yourselves for the record as well as the client you represent, and then please keep an eye on the clock. It tends to go quickly, and as I said, we look forward to the conversation. So, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Michael D. Ditburner, and I represent the appellant, Greta Garcia. We are asking the court to reverse the district court's December 10, 2018 order denying Ms. Garcia's relocation motion and to remand for further proceedings. Basically, we see errors and abuses of discretion in the way that the court applied 518.175 subdivision 3B and also in denying Ms. Garcia's request for an evidentiary hearing.
Can I jump right in? And as you frame the issue this way, that we should reverse the district court's decision on your client's relocation motion. So it's clear, I think, in the record that your client was making a relocation motion based upon the statute that governs out-of-state relocations.
That is correct.
But your argument on appeal, your principal argument is that statute doesn't apply because this isn't really an out-of-state or another state challenge. I'm at a loss for what you're asking us to do. Are you asking us to say the district court abused its discretion or erred as a matter of law by deciding your client's motion on the basis it was presented to the district court?
Both, Your Honor.
How would we do that? Well, I mean, when was the first time your client informed the district court that the district court was without authority to decide the motion that your client raised on the basis that your client raised it?
She didn't say that it was without authority. What she argued is that the factors in the statute should be applied in such a way to allow the motion to be granted.
The best interest factors.
Yes, in 518.
Talking about the principal argument that you're making, which is that the statute doesn't apply because this is not an out-of-state or another state relocation.
That is one argument that we did raise, Your Honor. But I think also, too, in the situation involving border states, there is implications of the law as applied here. And I think that that is an argument that I'm really principally trying to drive here.
I'm just trying to get a sense of how the district court would decide it. Your client brings a motion which implies that the statute applies. And then you're asking us to say the district court erred by agreeing with your client that the statute applies.
Well, that's one of the arguments that we've made about the phrase another state in the statute and when there's already been moved. You know, how is that implicated? But I think that even more so than that, what's really critical in this case.
What would be the procedural authority for this court to reverse the district court in that context?
Well, there are, I believe that you could view this as a refining of an argument that was made below in terms of the application of the statute.
When was the argument made in an unrefined way? That the district court lacks authority to grant your client's motion on the basis your client was raising.
I think that she did point out and acknowledge in her pleadings that there had already been a move, as did respondent note, that there had already been a move to Moorhead in January of 2012.
Right, that factual assertion was evident, but when was the argument made based upon that fact that therefore the statute that's being invoked doesn't apply?
Well, there really wasn't that type of full force type of argument, Your Honor.
When was there a half-hearted? I don't see it anywhere in the record. Are you You probably got better arguments, but you're stuck on this one.
Sure. I appreciate that, Your Honor. And it's really hard to see how that argument got developed in the lower court record, but that's sort of like consistent with what happens in.
You say hard to see how it got developed. Are you acknowledging that it was never developed at all?
Well, I appreciate your argument with regard to that, but it's just, I don't think it was really that developed, Your Honor. You know, and I'll concede that. But I will say that in post-decree motion practice in family law matters, one side has 14 days before the date of the hearing under the rules of general practice. The other side responds within 5 days. And there really isn't any kind of more provision for additional pleadings to be submitted.
Well, now, there's plenty of time before the filing, though, for your client. Your client was the one who raised the petition. Your client wasn't taken surprised by the petition. And the nature of the petition and the basis for it.
I think that she was taken surprised by the order. And I think that sometimes you see things in orders that you don't see in the motion papers. And I'll just give one recent example of a case, a published decision of this court that I was involved in, threadbare thin record. It was called Madden versus Madden. It was a published opinion from earlier this year. My client's former trial counsel in that case had offered basically a 2.25-page affidavit. And that affidavit did not include the legal argument that the court reversed the district court on, which had to do with the imputation of income from employment when there was no consequence that had been visited on my client in that case in the original district court order. So sometimes there are, in post-decree motion practice, those types of situations where the court will rule on a legal issue, even though that issue wasn't really raised.
Have you seen it in a case like this one, where the legal issue that you're saying wasn't raised is one that was conceded implicitly by the person raising the appeal?
Well, it wasn't really raised in Madden's case either, though. I mean, I think that's
not just raised. I mean, your client implicitly informed the district court, Judge, this is the statute that controls. The only statute that was the basis of the motion.
I can't say offhand. All I can speak to is from my experience with Madden versus Madden.
You probably have stronger arguments you want to get to, so I'll.
Yes.
Go for it.
Yes. So, really, this case, the driving factor in the decision of the district court, as I read the court's opinion, had to do with the belief that there would be reduced attendance at extracurricular activities and that somehow there was no way to come up with any kind of feasible alternatives. And so those are perhaps the key issues here. And it's really implicated by what happened previously, including the move to Moorhead after 4 short months. I mean, the children never really resided in the Hennig area except for 4 months. They were born and raised in the Holly area of northwestern Minnesota.
Well, Holly, Hennig, Moorhead, Fargo, I mean, they're all within a reasonable driving range.
That is correct, but
your client's asking the district court to agree to the children having a 4-hour commute each way once a week or twice a week, actually twice a week.
Right. It's certainly longer to Sioux Falls by, I would say, about 2.5 hours than it is to Fargo, where the appellant currently resides with her blended family. But the dilemma in this case really happens to do with the fact that the court said in its findings that respondent already acknowledges limited day-to-day involvement in the lives of the children. So the question is, how much more is there going to be limited involvement? I think that that's the case that he made below and in his brief, that there would be some kind of limited involvement.
It's sort of intuitive, isn't it, that a parent having to drive 1 hour to reach the children is likely to have at least the opportunity for more involvement than a parent who has to drive 4 hours.
That is correct, that there's going to probably be some less ability to attend extracurricular events. But my question
is, why doesn't that then put this in the range, this concern in the range of the district court's discretion?
Well, I think it comes from that because there was already reduced involvement as a result of the move to Moorhead and then Fargo, okay, occurring.
Well, from and the fact Moorhead to Fargo, it's not, I mean, we hold court occasionally in Moorhead, and if we do, we fly into Fargo. They're as Twin Cities as you get without being in the same state.
I understand that, but Father already complained about the fact that a move to Moorhead and Fargo was the reason why he was not able to be involved on a day-to-day basis with his children. And the court found that because he made that argument at blow. And so this is his argument. I have had reduced involvement.
I'm just trying to get a sense of why you think that argument's not logical. Dad says, look, you had this move once before, it's an hour. Now you want to add 3 more hours to the commute. It was difficult before and it reduced my ability to interact with the kids. And now you want to go even further. Why can't the court at least consider that as a basis for denying your claim?
Well, it can consider that, but it shouldn't be the tipping point. And I think it was a tipping point in this case, along with the court's belief that there weren't feasible alternatives.
What's the legal basis for the assertion that it can't be the tipping point?
I think this is a case of first impression. I've never seen a case involving a relocation where the tipping point was reduced attendance and extracurricular activities when there had already been a prior move that caused a reduction in attendance at extracurricular activities. I think when you look at the rationales that my client had for wanting to move to Sioux Falls, the offer of a job to her husband that occurred where she disclosed this in May of 2018, 6 months beforehand.
Can you address the other basis that the district court seemed to focus on, which is this, the fact that the children would have to now be in the car, I presume, for 8 hours a week?
Well, I mean, there's that claim, but there really isn't any kind of meat behind it in terms of the impact on the kids. And there's ways to create feasible alternatives that allow for, let's say, more time in the summer.
How will more time in the summer ameliorate the 8 hours in the car that the children would have to spend every week?
Well, I think that when you're talking about the relationship between the parent and the child, the court itself, the district court itself, acknowledged that there were feasible alternatives, that there could be more time in the summer, for example.
I'm not talking about more time.
And maybe
I'm talking about something different.
Right.
And it seemed like the district court was concerned on the burden on the children that this would create if the parenting time schedule remained the same, which seems to be conceded by both that it would or should, at least the district court seemed to be conceded. Why isn't that a factor the district court can consider in the best interest analysis?
The district court felt that there were feasible alternatives, and one way that you can do that is give the father the bulk of time during the summer, maybe not having as many weekends, and allowing these weekends to be extended by the school release day, which is something that Ms. Garcia requested. So I think that the district court itself acknowledged that there were feasible alternatives, but because Ms. Garcia did not formally bring a motion, that was, as far as they were concerned, problematic. And I don't think that there's anything in the statute at all that suggests that you have to bring a motion for modification of parenting time as a condition precedent to having your motion for relocation granted. In fact, she was just trying to say that, look, there's not going to be any changes to the parenting time schedule. She was trying to assuage the court's concern and respondents' concerns. And her attorney did, in fact, request a further conversation with the district court if they were prone to view her motion as being subject to being denied. And so they wanted to be able to do that. And in fact, she did try to at least give the alternative of the school release days, and also that she was going to take on more of the parenting time transportation responsibility so that it would be less of a problem for the respondent. And so these are all the different types of things that she did. And the court just basically said, there's feasible alternatives. Increase the time during the summer, but you know, because you didn't bring a motion, we can't do anything about it. And then the other legal issue is the issue with the outsized importance given to the children's relationship with their grandparents. And I'll concede, subdivision 518.1753B1 obviously looks at different people that are involved in the children's lives, and that would include grandparents. But the problem is that there were so many other findings regarding other factors in which the grandparents were being placed on the same plane as the respondent. And I think that that's what makes that an error of law in terms of how it treated the grandparents. In fact, they even cited, in analyzing the grandparents' relationship with the children, the Minnesota Supreme Court's guide to parenting time that was issued in 2001. And Your Honor, that was something that you saw in the case of In Re CDGD as problematic, in which
it was problematic in that case because you had the grandparent challenging, a grandparent versus a parent. And you had the grandparents grandparenting time statute versus the parenting time statute and the constitutional right to a parent and child relationship. That doesn't seem to be at play here. The district court, as I saw the analysis with the grandparents, seemed to be an additional consideration, not a primary factor, that the concern was dad's time with the kid. And by the way, the grandparents also would like to spend time, but it didn't seem to be about the grandparenting time. Correct me if I'm wrong about that.
But the problem is that I think that case is a little bit different, you know, in the fact that it involved grandparent versus parent in terms of how much parenting time to award. But I think that the principle in that case is that when a district court gives too much weight to the concerns of grandparents and basically mentions them in the same breath as the parent in terms of all these different issues, that's problematic under that rule in the NRA CDG. So it may not involve the same types of constitutional implications, but the principle still stands, in my opinion. Also, there's the issue of how much weight to give to the appellant's rationale for the move. There is the fact that she mentioned financial reasons associated with the move, and she also mentioned on-call. And I think on-call is a really serious issue, especially for a blended family, especially in a case in which you have 15 days per month that you're working on-call.
His being on-call, that Dr. Garcia's on-call?
Yes, yes. And even though that's him that it's happening to, it affects the whole family. Because when you never know when one of the parents, you know, a step-parent in this case, is going to be able to continue with an event or be able to be present at an event or be able to be present at home, you can't really make plans. And that's a stressor for a family, especially a blended family. And the respondent actually made the argument that it was financial concerns that were the principal motivating factor. So if he's conceding that those financial concerns were a motivating factor, he's basically agreeing that that is a meaningful benefit. And so on call, the elimination of the on-call hours is certainly a meaningful benefit. I see that my time has elapsed.
Anything further, Judge Ross?
No.
Okay. All right, and of course you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Before I get started, I want to take the opportunity to thank you or thank Mr. Ditburner for his professional courtesy. I had a bit of a mishap in filing the original brief. I just wanted the justice to know that he provided a letter not objecting to my late filing, and I did not ask him to do that. So,
and we appreciate that, counsel. I will ask you one housekeeping matter. Just identify yourself and the client you represent.
Sure.
Thank you.
Joe Ellig, and I represent the respondent, Brendan Markison.
Thank you. You can go ahead.
May it please the court. Your Honors, I think what happened here with the district court is that this is a classic example and a good example of where the law and common sense met. It simply just makes sense.
We know what the law is. I mean, the statute says another state. Is that the state, is that Minnesota? Is that another state where the respondent resides or where the custodial parent resides? Is it another state after a move? The statute seems to be unclear about that.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that it is unclear. I think the statute simply says another state. She is currently living in Fargo, North Dakota, so Sioux Falls.
The another is other than where the custodial parent
Correct.
Resides with the children.
Correct. And moreover on that, Judge, is that she agreed, as we agreed, that's the statute that applied. That it was unanimous. We all agreed that's the statute that applied at that hearing, and that's how the judge decided it. To argue otherwise now is contrary to the record.
So would you, if Ms. Garcia were to move to the opposite, the west, near the west border of North Dakota, the statute does not apply?
I don't think it would apply, Judge. Primarily because we're within the jurisdiction of Minnesota. I understand that probably presents a bit of a contradiction, but I really don't think it does. I understand in appellant's argument, they say, well, we're going to move regardless. And we're moving. If the Court of Appeals doesn't allow us to go to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, we're going to Laverne, Minnesota.
This is an interesting question because it's not before us. I think you make that argument.
Right.
It doesn't seem like it's before us, but it is a curious thing. If another state, other, is based upon where the custodial parent lives, and she's now living in North Dakota, and she were to then move next door to your client into Minnesota, or anywhere in Minnesota, I guess the plain language of the statute would say that if he doesn't consent to it, she can't move without a court order, even into Minnesota.
Well, Your Honor, what I would say is that, as you already pointed out, that issue is in front of us here today. And so unless Your Honor wishes for me to address
the statute is curiously written, and maybe the legislature doesn't always see all the possibilities, but but looking at the statute as it is written here, can you address the best interest factors?
Certainly.
Why is it in the children's best interest to allow for their custodial family or the home where they live custodially, the family unit that exists now, to remain intact with less chaos with this on-call circumstance?
Well, Your Honor, I thought about how to address this last night as I was sitting in bed trying to prepare a little bit more after I put my daughter to bed, and it dawned on me, sort of an anecdotal story, so if you'd just humor me for a minute. I thought about yesterday, my wife is also a lawyer, and she's out in Bismarck right now for a CLE, so while I love my wife dearly, I really look forward to having some alone time with my daughter. And so I picked her up from Y camp after work. We came home, we did a little gardening, planted the rest of the stuff we needed to plant. A neighbor kid stopped over, and she was releasing her pet turtle Penelope into their slough down below, and we visited outside. Then we had dinner, and we shot baskets, and then we watched a little SpongeBob, which I like, and then put her to bed. And I thought to myself, I was sitting there last night, what did I really love about all that? Well, a part of just being loving, being a dad, you can't do those things in a car. You can't take part in those things. You don't have those opportunities. Now,
it sounds like Mrs. Garcia would have been willing to concede to taking the lion's share of the driving, so that your client wouldn't have lost any time, at least during the parenting time period of the relationship.
She may say that now, but she didn't say that at the hearing, and she didn't say it in her affidavit. What she said was, I might be able to help with some additional driving in the summer. That's what she said. And so to say simply that it's only 4 hours is not true. It's 4.5 hours to get there. And not to mention, people got to stop to go to the bathroom. Let's not forget the realities of things. Get something to eat. And so if Brennan is going to pick up his kids on Friday evening, and we've got essentially 5 hours of time from when they have to, you know, get done with school, maybe they have soccer practice, maybe they have this, that, and the other, but all that time, basically, they get home to Henning and they go to bed. And so that anecdotal story I told you about with my daughter, those things are completely eliminated. You don't have that, you don't even have that opportunity to share those experiences with your children. That's important. That's what's common sense. And that's what district court was getting at here.
How clear was Ms. Garcia's adherence to the current parenting time schedule in the district court?
Crystal. Absolutely crystal clear. Her attorney said it. She said it in her affidavit. They said, we don't want any changes to the schedule. And so to argue otherwise, that the district court somehow had it was supposed to unilaterally just make changes because it's advantageous for them in order to be successful at the motion hearing, when it's contrary to not only my client's request and also her request, that doesn't make sense. She did say that she would allow some non-school days that would be adjacent to weekends. Now, looking at those, that's only maybe a couple of days a year. And if it doesn't fall on his weekend, he wouldn't get those days. So adding one or two days for the whole year for 9 hours of travel time every other week, that doesn't make sense. Not to mention the imposition on these poor kids. I mean, to think, you know, I think what's important to point out here, Judge, is that a lot of the things that appellant agrees on, the schools that they were looking at in Sioux Falls are similar. The school that they're in now is nice. They live in a nice community. They live in a nice house. They're doing well. My client sees them regularly. The appellant doesn't dispute that extended family interact with them regularly. The appellant doesn't dispute that there's extended family in the area, not only my client's family, but her family. There isn't any family in Sioux Falls. And also, Ms. Garcia is able to be home with the kids most or all of the time. And they also agree that they're financially stable. So what's the difference? Well, they can live in a bigger house. Mr. Garcia can make more money. And theoretically, he could be home more. Now, what we don't have here, we don't have any contracts, any job descriptions, any schedules, any wages, nothing depicting and quantifying how much more Mr. Garcia is going to be home other than what Mr. Garcia is saying. I have to work on call in Fargo. If I go to Sioux Falls, I won't have to, and I'll be able to be home more.
Well, the district court didn't seem to base its decision on a lack of evidence of those circumstances, but it seemed, as I read the order, that the district court assumed that those were in fact supported and not really in dispute. Am I misreading the order?
No, I don't think, I don't necessarily think so, Judge. I think it could also be read that since there wasn't a significant amount of weight put on that, I think you could infer that. Because, you know, had there been specific evidence provided by Ms. Garcia, perhaps that would have been considered more. They could have. They're the ones who brought the motion. They know they were going to bring it. They know they were looking at it. They were looking at homes. They were looking at schools. And not to mention, you know, what does this do to the kids? And what does this say to about the father to the kids? Knowing that the father doesn't want the kids to move, they take the kids down there anyways and look at schools and look at the community. And they're looking at houses. That sends the wrong message to the children about what their father's worth is and what their relationship is with their children.
That issue's not before us, I take it. I mean, it seems that you're suggesting some impropriety in the way the issue was broached with the children by Ms. Garcia.
I'm not so sure I understand your question, Judge, but I'm gonna take a stab at it. By me suggesting that, Judge, and I think I suggest that in Mr. Markison's brief, that I think it goes to the best interest factors, whether or not the district court specifically acknowledged them. But it was an allegation that was brought in Ms. Garcia's brief or in her affidavit, and so I felt it important to address it. So. I think it's important to point out, as we talked about earlier, that, and to the same point that I just made, that Ms. Garcia says she's going to move regardless. She says in her brief, the move is inevitable. Now, this is not a type of case, and I would point your honors to the unpublished cases of Ogilvie and also Tompack versus Tompack, where this court had denied similar circumstances where the spouse that was looking to move simply said, I'm going to move because the financial circumstances are going to be better somewhere else where I'm going to move. And in there was no mention of specifics like this case. And they also said, I have to move, and the move is inevitable. Well, this court in those both cases said, you don't have to move. There's nothing here that says you have to move. In this case, they don't have to move. There's no information to indicate that he's tried to find a job anywhere else in the area that's closer. And besides, well, I appreciate Mr. Garcia being able to make a lot of money. That's great. But it shouldn't be at the detriment to my client. He's a step-parent in this situation. And yes, he's involved with the family, but his interests, his financial interests, should not be the detriment to the biological father. And therein lies part of the hypocrisy of Ms. Garcia's argument, in that they say the grandparents, the paternal grandparents and their family, shouldn't be given as much significance. It's important to point out that at the same time, they're arguing Mr. Garcia's interests should be given almost paramount interest, because that's the reason for the whole move, is because of him. And then that's contrary and contradicts the whole argument. Now, what I also think is important to point out, Judge, is that this financial benefit shouldn't, as I just mentioned, shouldn't necessarily be at the detriment of the biological father. And now you look at what actually is going to be the benefit here to the kids. Like I said earlier, the kids are already well established in Fargo. Nobody disputes that they're doing well in Fargo. They're in a community that they're doing well. They have friends. They play basketball. They're in various activities. And for all intents and purposes, are doing well. Why do we want to disrupt that? Why do we want to take them from what they know in a situation that they're doing well and put them 4.5 hours away from their father and their extended family? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appellant, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Minnesota's statute regarding removal seems to pivot on a state's geographical borders. There are other states in the country that do it within a certain number of miles. And I think that's where the problem lies in terms of how broad is the discretion. Are there any possibilities that there can be abuses of discretion given that fact?
Well, if there's a problem, it seems to be with the wording of the statute framing the issue around the boundaries of a state, whether it's the custodial parent state or some other state, as you've suggested in your brief. But we're bound by the statute, and the district court was bound to follow the statute.
Well, if the statute produces an absurd result, you know, that's a problem. And the fact of the matter is that a move could occur to Dickinson or Williston, North Dakota. That's much further away than Sioux Falls.
Therefore, we should invalidate the statute? What should we say?
I'm not suggesting at all, Your Honor, that we invalidate the statute. I'm just saying that the anomalies that are presented by a statute such as this, and how discretion cannot be unbridled.
Well, it could be in a different case, but in this case, your client is requesting to move the children from a location in her current residential state further than the current distance between the children's residence and their father. So it's not absurd in this state. You're suggesting it might be absurd in other circumstances, but you're not suggesting it was absurdly applied here.
Well, it would certainly be absurd if she could move to southwestern Minnesota, which is the same amount of distance from Henning, just across the border. All she is being inconvenienced then, along with the children being inconvenienced, in that they have to drive 30 miles into Sioux Falls for school and has to be away from a further distance from where her husband works.
You're assuming that there wouldn't be a motion to amend the parenting time schedule or perhaps even custody if your client were to do what you suggest in your brief, which is we're going to move anyway.
Well, she's going to have to bring a motion to accommodate the interests of parenting time. she's going to have to do that squarely in any kind of relocation to Southwest.
If she relocates.
Yeah, so, I mean, she's going to have to be able to try to come up with some kind of game plan, work out an agreement.
The district court didn't seem to buy the premise that you're suggesting that a move is required.
Well, I think that...
I've never presented to the district court. By the way, your brief suggests that a move is inevitable regardless of what this court does or what the district court did. Was that presented to the district court, that scenario, that this is inevitable?
No, that was not presented by her to the district court. But when somebody, as early as May of 2018, raises the issue of a relocation, when it is a job offer that has been actually made, you know, people have to consider those types of things if they're not able to move to the city of choice, that there's going to be a move to Southwest Minnesota. And the issue of borders is a very patent.
The court should have inferred that if your client's motion was denied, your client was going to move regardless.
I think a court should always try to consider whether or not its orders are effective. You know, if by blocking a move to Sioux Falls, that simply invites a different move to Laverne, for example. You know, I think that it should be inherent in any kind of analysis by a court in granting or denying a relocation motion, especially when you have border states. And that's the aspect of this case. It's a border state type of issue.
Counsel, what's your best argument for reversal? I mean, what's the reversible error in this case that would cause us to overturn the district court's decision?
I think the best argument is the fact that there are feasible alternatives to enhance and foster the relationship between Mr. Markison and his children.
The district court was required to make a best interest determination. It made one. It explained it. It provided findings to support it. And to reverse this, we'd essentially have to substitute our judgment for the district court.
Oh, I totally disagree with that, Your Honor. I really do believe that the reasons for denying the move were really weak. And I think that is really a question of the outer limits of discretion, but it's also a question of an error of law in terms of the application of the statute to the facts of this case.
Okay, and getting back to that, why doesn't the invited error doctrine prohibit you from arguing that the statute under which you requested relief does not apply here? Are you familiar with the invited error doctrine?
I can't say that I am, Your Honor.
Well, here's what it says. The doctrine of invited error precludes a party from asserting error on appeal which he invited or could have prevented in the court below. An appellate court will not permit a party to place himself in a position where, if the verdict is satisfactory, he can abide by it, but if it is against him, he may avoid it. It would seem to me that that's exactly what you're doing here. You asked for relief under subdivision 3. You lost. Now you're arguing the district court should not have considered subdivision 3 and erred in doing so.
I'm just saying that the district court said that there are feasible alternatives. They've made a full-throated finding on that. Thank you. I see my
time.
Thank
you, counsel.
Thank you.
So this matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time period, and it's our thanks to counsel for your presentation here today. Thank you very much.